Hello and welcome to our Institute of Nutritional Endocrinology Office Hours Calls. This is Dr. Rita Marie Loscalzo, and I love being here to share with you every month, a place where you can come and just ask whatever questions are coming up for you related to whatever program you're participating in and your various clients, and even if it's something related to your own self or family members, because I feel like we really do learn best when we study, when we look. And even if you don't have a bunch of clients or patients right now, working on your own labs and your own self and working yourself through the program is a really important piece of it. So we did have a couple of people who typed in questions in advance, and we had a couple of people who put up some labs in advance. So I'm going to right now open up that folder that has those labs in it. Some of those were last minute. They were just submitted. I would so appreciate it for future reference if you get anything you want me to review on a call like this to us in advance, because it takes some time to download it and get it available. So that would be really helpful. I'm going into the folder. She said it was INE. There's IRSPT cases. Grace submitted some stuff, and where else? Okay, well, I'll just kind of go along, and if you're on the call and you submitted something, then get up on the, you have to get on the phone if you've submitted some labs or anything, because that's the only way I could really interact with you to do it. So if you're listening in and you submitted something that you wanted me to review, then please go ahead and dial in on the phone, and we'll do it that way. So, hang on one second. This happened again to me. I'm going to have to start all over because it's this recording did not record. This happened yesterday to me, too, and I missed the recording, so I'm glad I caught it now. We try it again. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our Institute of Nutritional Endocrinology Office Hours for the month of July 2016. I'm Dr. Rita Marie Loscalzo, and I'm excited to be here so that I can share with you and answer your questions and support you and coach you through the process of coaching your clients through whatever process you're taking them through, whether it's insulin resistance or digestion, if you're in the digestion program, or if you're in the nutritional endocrinology practitioner training, foundations or certification, then whatever particular areas that you need help with. Anything goes on these calls. So, and I do my best to answer all the questions that get submitted. We did have a few questions that came in advance. We'll look at those. I just want to say that if you have cases or labs or anything you wanted me to look at on the call, it's best to get them to me the night before so that we have some time to get them, or the day before is actually better, within 24 hours is best, so that we have time to get them loaded to a spot where I can conveniently see them during the call and do my best to help you so I don't have to scramble around looking for things. So the way this works is if you're on the line, you have a question, looks like Grace does, and she submitted some stuff, we're going to raise your hand with the star 2. If you're on the web only, then you just type into the chat or you type into the Q&A box and I'll answer your questions. Looks like we had several people who did some advanced stuff, so we'll get to those. So since Grace was quick on the draw and raised her hand, I'm going to start with her, and then I'm going to go to Joan. And anybody else, you'll go in order. It numbers your hand, so it makes it real easy for me to go in order. So I'm going to put Grace on. Hi, Grace.
Hi, Dr. Rita Marie. How are you doing?
I'm doing wonderfully. So what you wanted me to go through was some DNA results?
Yes.
Some methylation? Okay.
And I want to know what the difference, red means broken, right?
Okay, I can review that, yeah. And you know what, if anybody wants to see this, is it okay to share the screen on these?
Oh, sure.
Okay, so we're going to start with the detox, and I'm going to share with you a couple of things. Let's see, if I go to Join Me, so go to join.me and I'll share my screen. Let's see, where's my screen share window? Okay, so if you go to join.me, you should be able to see the screen. Wow, Grace, yours is pretty good looking. So you should be able to see the screen. And this is a profile from Genetic Genie that's based on the 23andMe methylation. Well, not just methylation. These reports are more methylation and detox. But the 23andMe does the full genetic snip, not every single gene that we know about, but quite a number of them, you know, hundreds of thousands of them. And you get this data, this like 6 megabyte raw data that you can download, and then you can feed into these other filters, which Grace did. And it's Genetic Genie, so geneticgenie.org. And then you upload that raw data file and you get this Genetic Genie report. And they have two of them, one for detox pathways and one for the methylation pathways. So this is the CYPs stand for cytochrome P450. And there's a whole bunch of different enzymes involved in detoxification in the liver, phase one and phase two. Most of the ones listed here are phase one, although the ones at the bottom are phase two. So all the CYPs in here are phase one and the rest of them are phase two. So what this does is tell us a little bit about what's going on genetically for Grace. She's got, when it's green, it means that mom and dad both gave you a good gene. Like it's what it's expected to be. And when there's a variation in that, it's called a single nucleotide polymorphism. And it means that either one or both of the genes gotten from the parent are not what's supposed to look like. And the nucleotides are actually what makes up your genes. So you know, DNA is all made up of these nucleotides. And there's a C, T, A, and G. And there's pairs. And so they should be paired together. The strand from mom and the strand from dad at that point should be the same because it's supposed to code for specific set of functions, proteins, etc. So if they're both the same, like for example, the first one here, cytochrome P1A1, that one is TT and it's minus minus green, which means it's perfectly fine. That's what's supposed to be there as a T. Okay. On the one that's CYP1B1 that's yellow, that means that one parent gave a different variation there that's not supposed to be there. So it's CG there. Now, based on the way they give this report without going and doing some digging, we don't know whether the C is right or the G is right. Some of the reports will give what they call the risk allele, which means that that one is the one that's wrong. So if, say, the risk allele was listed as G, that means that this should be CC, but now it's CG, and or vice versa. Okay, so one gene, one not. Now, what happens is that decreases the functioning of that particular pathway, that particular function, because the body is not able to code for those proteins adequately. So it's said, and it varies a lot from gene to gene, but that yellow, which we call heterozygous, the heterozygous polymorphism, or a heterozygous single nucleotide polymorphism, which means that you get usually somewhere between 20 and 40% decrease in the function of that particular area, that particular gene. Now, you'll see that there's a lot of variations on them. So the body has a lot of duplication and backup. So if you have that, and there's a whole bunch of other, like there's the CYP1B1. There's three of these major ones. There's probably more of them. These are the ones that have been found to have the major functions. The 1B1s are actually... there's three here, and she's got one of them is a no-call, meaning they didn't find anything there, and that happens sometimes. We don't know whether it's an error in the, you know, the sample or that there's no gene there. I'm not sure exactly what that means, but she's got one that's green, one that's yellow. So she wouldn't lose the function of the CYP1B1 by as much as 20 to 40%. It's probably less because there's some backup there. Now, on the CYP1A2, you see there's only one major one there, and hers is homozygous, okay, which means that she's got a bad gene from both parents. Instead of CC, it probably should be GG, so she's got a CC there. Now, there's interpretations of these. If you want to know more about what they mean, you're going to have to look up the gene itself or this RSID on something called Snipedia. Or GeneWise. Those in our professional program, our two-year certification, where we actually have a module on all this, have access to a spreadsheet that I put together for my Energy Recharge Inner Circle people, and it's several pages long, and it lists each of those genes and says what they're for. I'm going to just open that up right now and just to give you a sense of it. I don't want to go through each and every one because reading a gene sample takes, you know, it could take a half an hour to 45 minutes. And you don't just do it in a vacuum. There's other questions you want to ask somebody. But I just want to give you a sense of what the possibility is. And for those of you who are in NEPT, you know you have access to this. So I'm going to open up that. We have a whole section in our Energy Recharge Inner Circle, which is the program that we actually support people with their own health, and that's more where we do these. But I'm just going to give you a little glimpse of it right now since you took the time to put this in here. And I have these things. And, Joan, I know you're in ERC and a couple of the others of you, so you'll be getting access to this as soon as you need it, as soon as you run your stuff. If you run the genetics and have it, you will open up that module for you. So I'm going to open up the detox interpretation, and I'm just going to give you a quick glance at what I have. Let me just see if I can change it. Share window. So this is what I put together to help you interpret that. Again, you know, this took like dozens of hours to put together, and we're still working on more and more of these. So if I look up that, it was the 1B1. Was that the one that we had a problem with here? Let me look it up again. Or was it, no, the 1A2, that was red. So if we look that one up in this chart, the 1A2, this affects caffeine metabolism and estrogen metabolism and can increase the risk of breast cancer, ovarian cancer, and prostate cancer. So it's a particular pathway in the liver that breaks down not only caffeine but estrogen. And estrogen needs to be broken down into the safe metabolites versus the unsafe metabolites, and those need to be excreted appropriately. And when that doesn't happen, so I would say that for you, the way I would interpret this would be in terms of action, because we always want to, for our patients and clients, give them actions. It would be really careful about caffeine because it's going to stress that pathway. And then on the estrogen metabolism side, you want to be doing things to protect your hormones. So that would be making sure your B vitamins are good, making sure your iodine level is good, and also making sure that you get plenty of cruciferous vegetables and sulforaphane in your diet, especially broccoli sprouts. There are supplements called DIM and I3C, indole-3 carbonyl and diindolemethane, which are used to help support pathways like this. I don't always use those necessarily. If I have somebody who doesn't want to make changes, right, they're like, oh, I don't want to make dietary changes, that's too much. Or that, you know they have to, but they're going, oh, I have all these other dietary changes, is there a pill? I give them the DIM or the I3C to help support it. But realistically, we just want to really up the levels of those cruciferous vegetables and things containing sulforaphane. So that gives you, in a nutshell, what's going on with you. And I'm going to switch back over to your other one, and then I'll open for your question. So really, when I look at this, what I said, Grace, this is one of the better ones I've seen, because usually I see a lot of things in here, because I'm working with a lot of sick people. And I see, I have people who have, like, half of these are red, and a bunch of them are yellow, and only a small percentage are green, which means that these are people, when you see something like this, and there's a lot of these, you've got to go so carefully if you're going to put somebody on a detox program. Because as soon as they start mobilizing their fat and the toxins stored in that fat, they can't carry it through their liver in these pathways to detoxify it fast enough, and those levels build up in the bloodstream. So you just have a few of them. This is quite a good profile. The one I would watch the most would be that 1A2. I think the 1B1 also, which you have a yellow. Let me just look at that real quick. I think that one also, 1B1. Yeah, that. So you have two of them. One's a homozygous, one's a heterozygous. So when we say, see, yellow means heterozygous, or heterozygous is yellow, is what it really should be. And then homozygous is red. So you've got the 1A2 is the caffeine, but also the 1B1, and you've got the 1B1 as a yellow. So I just watch the caffeine and really support your estrogen. Make sense?
Yes, it does. I don't do caffeine, so I don't have to worry about that.
Good. Yeah. Good reason. It just reinforces that you shouldn't be. Okay, so the other one that you had, which I'll open up right now, is your methylation. I'll share this with people on the methylation. The methylation one does give you a little report so you can read that. Sometimes it's confusing because some of the things that they cover on the report are like, oh, here it says don't eat cruciferous, here it says do eat cruciferous. In general, I say eat the cruciferous. Some people have impaired sulfur metabolism pathways, very rare that they can't tolerate it, and some people have to lower the amounts down, but I would never avoid it completely. I've had people do that. Now, on the other hand, your methylation pathways, you've got a lot more concern here, all right? So the one people hear about most is MTHFR, and there's two major MTHFRs that we look at, the C677T. Can you see my screen? Is it showing?
I lost out on, I think I have to restart because my thing froze up. So
okay.
Somebody
else might be able to tell me. You have it in front of you, so it doesn't matter. But if anybody, because it's really confusing when I just go through stuff. Are you guys still seeing my screen? Are you seeing the methylation report? You're not? Okay, let me try this again. It gets a little confused when I try flipping between them. How's that? You seeing the methylation? Then type it in and type into the chat.
Okay, I'll be back. I have to restart.
Okay. All right, I'll just talk about this and she can catch it on the replay. Are you guys seeing you're not seeing it? Why does it keep flipping off? Okay, share window. Okay, how about now? Okay, it says your window is now being shared. Is it there? Yes? Yay! Okay. All right. So I think what I'll do, I'll leave that up. And since she's had to leave because her – are you still on the phone, Grace, or are you gone completely? Yeah, she's gone completely. So she had to reboot her computer. So I'll just leave this up and we can come back to it. And in the meantime, we'll go to see who else has a question because I think Joan had a question as well. I don't want to just wait, and I'd rather her not miss it. Okay, so, all right. I'm going to just pause the share screen for now. What happened there? Okay. That's funny. The window is not available. Okay, good. I lowered it. Okay, so that'll help. I'm going to go back to see if Joan still has her hand up, and I'll open up her line.
Hi, Dr. Rita Marie.
Hi, Joan.
Hi, Dr. Rita Marie. How are you?
Good. How are you, Joan?
I'm fine, thank you. I had probably a couple weeks ago uploaded my labs in regards to my thyroid, the PRT program I'm working through. So I don't know if you have access to those. Lynn had said that they would be reviewed on the call.
Oh, yeah. Usually they're reviewed on the VLM call. But if nobody else has questions, there's two calls on the same day back-to-back, and you have access to both of them. One is the client one and one is the practitioner one, but I don't think anybody here minds. Type in the chat if you mind us going over a thyroid thing because that's a good learning opportunity. Anybody mind? Everybody okay with us doing a thyroid one? I don't see any other hands up, so I can do that. Lynn, just tell me where it is. It's probably in this client labs. Okay, let's see.
Okay, I didn't realize there was another call.
Yeah, there's two in a row. I'm looking at changing them so they're not back to back on the same day because everybody says that's fine. Okay, good. Because I know a lot of you are in the IRSPT, so I want to make sure that we're giving ample time for the blood sugar stuff too. Let's see. So Gold, Lynn, you're going to just have to tell me where. Okay, TRT, I found it. And there's Joan. Yay, found it. And there's so you wanted to look at the lab tracker. Is there anything particular on here? Is it all on the lab tracker or a combination of all these files?
Probably it's all on the lab tracker.
Okay, we'll start there. And if there's anything more I need. So I won't need the lab results because that's just the lab report.
Then
I can look at your temps as well because the temps will make sense too.
Right. And the temps are all low.
Okay, I'm going to put both of these up side by side, and then I'll just share my whole window so people can see it side by side, and it'll make more sense on the recording. But there isn't a recording. I got to start a recording if I want to do that. Let's see if it'll let me do that. Start recording. Record. Okay. Okay, so temps. All right, so I'm going to squeeze that. So here's the temps. And for those of you who've done our thyroid program, you know we have a lot of great stuff in there. This is a consumer level, which is what we call it, versus a practitioner level. Probably next year we'll have a practitioner level thyroid program too. Okay, I'll be sharing in a moment. I just want to put these together so it... Okay, there we go. All right, so I'm going to do this. I'm going to say share window. Not share window, I need to do share screen. Share screen. All right, so what you should see, you can tell me if you do, Joan, what you should see here is your lab tracker, and you should, oops, that's the wrong one. I don't want her. There, I don't want that. I wanted that. It was a Word file, right? I had it in a Word file. Where is it? Your temps, your temps, your temps. Here a minute ago. The hardest thing is keeping track of all these screens. So let me see. Here it is. Nope, that's not it. Let me just open it again. Oh, it's a PDF. That's why I wasn't finding it. Okay, yes, yeah, so you printed it and then did it. Okay, so here we go. So are you seeing your temps next to your lab tracker?
Yes.
Okay, good. Let me move this thing out of the way. All right, so Joan did our complete panel. You know, we really recommend that you don't just get TSH. Obviously, you guys know why. So thyroid stimulating hormone is TSH, and that's what the gold standard is in medicine. Hers is 1.22, so she'd be looked at and said, okay, everything's fine. Go about your business. Are you on any medication, first of all?
No.
No. Okay. And do you have symptoms? Have you done, like, the symptom survey and come up with whether you have low thyroid symptoms?
Well, the assessment.
The assessment.
Thyroid assessment. So
yep.
The low thyroid is 52%.
Ouch.
The thyroid excess is 17, and the pituitary is 22.
Okay.
And I have a thyroid nodule.
Oh, you have a nodule. Okay, got it. Usually a nodule means that there's some autoimmune going on here. And let's just see, you have your thyroid antigen. Okay, so we're not seeing a lot of antibody activity here, so the TPO is elevated a little bit, but it's below 10. Your thyroid globulin is below 1. So we're not seeing it, but I do see that sometimes where people have those symptoms of both a little bit, and then they also have a nodule. So the nodule is there. It's probably an autoimmune. It just, the levels of the antibodies haven't gotten up much for whatever reason. The biggest issue I see here is this, your free T3. You see that, 2.3? We want that to be at least 3, right? And so even if you're making plenty of thyroid, which you're borderline, you're at the low end of normal on making the thyroid hormone itself, but your free T4 is fine, but it's not converting. So it's just sitting there. And my guess is if you did your reverse T3, you'd find that elevated because the T4 has to go somewhere, and it's either going to get converted to T3 or it's going to get converted to reverse T3. So that's the area you need to work on. But I always assume that people have thyroid receptor issues. Always assume that because we can't really test for that. You can look for risk factors of receptor issues, but so many people have perfectly normal labs and they have all the temperature problems and they have an issue. Now look at her temps. This is much more indicative of thyroid health than TSH. This should be 98.6. Well, her awakening is lower. Her Broda Barnes always says he talked about this back in the 50s and wrote a book on it, Hypothyroidism, the Unsuspecting Illness. Because you can't go by the labs, you have to go by the temps. So her first mornings are 96.5, 96.6, 96.4. I mean, that's super, super low. It should be, the first morning should be somewhere between 97.7 and 98.2. Somewhere in there. And then around the day is somewhere in the neighborhood of 98.6. She's nowhere near that. see. So she got up to 98.8 here, which is interesting because it's very out of character, and a couple of them here. So I'd be looking at maybe there's something you're doing, taking, that's giving you a little boost at that point that might be supporting your receptors, or if you just came out of the hot sun or a sauna or something, or just running or something like that. So I've been looking at that. But overall, they look like you're mostly in those, you know, low to mid 97s, right? Except this one day. Are you menstruating or are you past that? You're past
that.
Past
that.
Yeah, because sometimes what we see is as they start, if you ovulate, that number's going to go up. So I would say, oh, well, look at this. Maybe she's ovulating, but that's not your in your case, right? So your average was 97.3, 97.3, 98. Still, everything's much lower than it should be. Clearly, the T3 needs to come up, okay? There's a lot of things you can do to convert the T4 to T3. You have to have good amounts of selenium and iodine, zinc, magnesium. So all your trace minerals need to be at good levels. So that's a big thing. You can do 4 Brazil nuts a day. You can do 400 micrograms of selenium, but that's going to help support that. And when you're working with clients, you want to make sure you're looking at what are the factors. But the other issue you always have to look at is what's going on at the receptor level, because you can have everything look perfect and still have a 52% on the symptoms if your receptors aren't working. And receptor resistance, very common, happens a lot with this reverse T3 going up. So I would say I don't always do reverse T3. I do it when I'm not getting the results I think I should, because I can usually suspect. I'm just suspecting your reverse T3 is high. So what we want to do is support this conversion from T4 to T3. Well, low cortisol or high cortisol impact that. If you're stressed out and you're in sympathetic dominant mode and you have too much cortisol, it causes the more of the T4 to convert to reverse T3. And so if you got too little and you're in a state of adrenal fatigue, same thing happens. You need the Goldilocks principle of cortisol in order to convert T4 to T3. So we need low stress. We need to get our cortisol's balanced. We need to have balance of selenium is the most important one, but iodine is super important, and you shouldn't be supplementing selenium if you have low iodine without supplementing both. Magnesium and the other trace minerals like zinc are also important. B vitamins can be important too. On the receptor level, though, it's a little bit different. On the receptor level, we're looking at deficiencies of vitamin A can cause that. And I've been looking at a lot of genetics lately, and I see a lot of people with a particular SNP. Remember, that's a polymorphism, single nucleotide polymorphism, where one of those letters is swapped, where people don't have the full capacity to convert the beta carotene to vitamin A. So if they're eating a lot of great plant foods that have beta carotene in it, they're probably skin turning yellow and they're not actually converting a lot of it to vitamin A. So sometimes giving a free form, I like mycelized vitamins because they get in better, or liposomal. I haven't seen liposomal A, but I've seen mycelized A. Helps it to get absorbed. So you might need vitamin A. But the other thing that can do it, and this is easy to check on your blood test, is homocysteine, high homocysteine. What can cause high homocysteine? Well, some of those MTHFR things that we're going to talk about in a bit when Grace gets back on the call. The other thing that it could be is that you have deficiencies of some of the vitamins that help to support that whole methylation pathway and reduce the homocysteine. Because homocysteine is like an intermediate product that at normal levels is fine, but when it builds up, it's neurotoxic and it's toxic to the endothelial linings of the blood vessels. So looking at your homocysteine levels, looking at making sure your B vitamins, especially B6, B12, and folate, are super critical for having good thyroid function as a result. The other thing that's super important is riboflavin, vitamin B2, and that helps in the receptors and in the conversion, the activation. So B vitamins, critical, like getting a really good B complex would make it so that you could just try it out and see without having to really dig deeper. I always like to dig deeper just to make sure you're giving the right amounts. But a good hearty B vitamin could be very helpful in this particular case, along with some selenium, some trace minerals, and you're addressing your stress. Does that all make sense?
Okay. Yeah. So when I was at SIV and I tested my minerals, my selenium came up that it was adequate or even a little bit over.
Mm-hmm.
And I do eat Brazil nuts, and I figured that's probably why it's adequate. So that's
okay.
Kind of strange.
So you probably don't need more selenium. It's probably not the selenium part then, right? So selenium's
yeah.
one of those things. So it could be the cortisol. It could be the magnesium. It could be iodine.
Okay.
Iodine's
so
an easy one to test. You can go and to Hakala Lab, H-A-K-A-L-A, and do their iodine load test. And I would do the full panel that has all the halides there, because it could be that your iodine's okay, but you have too much bromine or fluoride, and that's attaching to the iodine receptors and not causing this. And it could be the iodine, because I'm looking here, and you're at the low end of normal on the actual T4 production, right? And you need iodine to make the hormone itself. Usually with thyroid, it's multifactorial. It's not just one thing. Oh, this person has a conversion issue. We'll do this. This person has a receptor issue. We'll do that. Usually it's a combination of all of that. And what happens is, in the standard medical approach, and even some, naturopathic cycles where they just say, oh, yeah, we'll give you armor, you're missing the boat. You're just giving – it's a supply issue. The way Dr. Wilson talks about it, love his interpretation, he says, you got to look at it's the supply issue, but it's also the availability of the thyroid hormone to the cells. And so if it's a supply issue, then you have to help the body make more thyroid hormone. But if it's not a supply issue, it's a conversion issue or a receptivity issue, you've got to address that. And no matter how much supply you give it, you're not going to really help that problem if you don't address the conversion and the receptors. And I think there's some autoimmunity here. So addressing the immune system. Yes. You've got very low levels of the antibodies, but the fact that you have a nodule and the fact that you have some fluctuating symptoms of high and low would give me that. If you had a series of your thyroid tests and I saw, TSH was 1.22, now it's 4, now it's 0.2, then I would say for sure that's a clear signal that there's most likely an autoimmune. So in the Thyroid Revive and Thrive, we give a whole process for dealing with the immune. It starts with healing your leaky gut. It's, again, getting your blood sugar balance. We'll be doing all of that this year in ERC with you to take you through the whole thing.
Okay. And I'm working through the TRT now, and so I've been on an autoimmune protocol before, so I know how to do that. But mm-hmm. I wanted to make sure that I really do have an autoimmune issue and not just make assumptions. Mm-hmm. Because the other thing I was thinking about, trying to get more iodine, so if you have Hashimoto's, you're not supposed to have too much iodine. Is that correct?
Everything's Goldilocks, okay? So too much or too little iodine will hurt Hashimoto's. There's some bad rumors going around that nobody should take iodine. They shouldn't even eat seaweed if they have Hashimoto's. That's a bunk of it's crazy. It's not good science, because without iodine, you cannot make thyroid hormone. Cannot. Okay? So you need it, but you need the right quantity. If it's too much, it can cause the thyroid to attack itself more. You're not in – if you were in 1,000, your antibodies were in the hundreds or thousands, I'd be a lot more cautious. That's why I say do the test. The test will tell you.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's so much more that iodine does. Iodine converts the estrogens like estriol and estradiol, which can be prolific and can contribute to estrogen-sensitive cancers, into estriol. And that's the safe one. That's the protective one. And we need a certain ratio. Without enough iodine, you don't have that ratio, and then you're in a dangerous situation with your sex hormones. So lots to think about here. But, yeah, so iodine, always just test and see if you need it. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
One supplement that, they have two versions of it, one with high iodine, one with just a trace, restorative formulas. So if you go to restorative formulations, I think, restorativeformulations.com, it's called ThyroCare, and that's the one with the lower iodine. And they have, the other one is called Thyroid PX, and that's the one with the higher iodine. So depending, I tend towards the ThyroCare, and then supplement the iodine separately in people who are kind of in the middle of the deficiency. But if somebody's like super low, they don't have to take an extra supplement, I just go with the full one. And that can help a lot with all of these issues. So it works with the receptors, it works with the conversion, and it works with the iodine, so that works with the supply if you do the PX one. So it's restorativeformulations.com. If they ask you, they will ask you, unless you're a licensed healthcare practitioner, you can set up an account with them. If not, they will ask you for your practitioner's code, and I will give you mine right now if you want to write it down.
Yes.
512-349-9677.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, you're welcome.
Thank you.
Super. You're so welcome. Okay. I'm going to go back to, let's see, we'll close that one. And I'll go back to the screen here. And let's see. Angela has her hand up. Grace back? Grace, if you're back, put your hand up. And then I'll know that we'll get you. In the meantime, I'll get it. Angela. Hello, Angela.
Hi, Dr. Rita Marie. How are you?
Good. You were on a call yesterday, and I kept opening your line, and you had your hand up, and I couldn't get to you. I don't know what happened, but I apologize for not being able to answer your question.
I'm so sorry. I was on a call. I had to click over to another meeting that started at 1, and I didn't realize that it came on the call until I tried to hang up with them, and I heard you guys talk again. It was great. Yeah, so I just have a couple of probably random questions. Not random, but not really together. Going on what you were just talking about, and I might have missed it because I was sitting down at a restaurant. Yeah, I'm on the phone. Probably for the next 20 minutes. You were talking about a testing for adequate iodine.
Right.
And how do you do that?
Yes,
I don't know if I missed it.
It's a lab called Hakala Lab, and they do what they call an iodine load test. And I'll explain what that means. That you basically, they do a spot just to see what your level of iodine is. And then you take a 50 milligram dose of iodine. So it's a hefty dose. And then given that you took a hefty dose like 50 milligrams, you should be excreting at least 90% of that, right, because it's way over and above what you need. Then they have you collect your urine for 24 hours to see just how much of it you do excrete over the 24 hours. And if it's less than 90%, then we're pretty clear that there's probably an iodine deficiency because your body was hanging on to it. It's like, ooh, iodine, I need that. Ooh, let me use that. And I've seen people as low as 45%, but they are actually. So those people are severely iodine deficient. But the other part of that test, which I really like to do, so it's optional, but I totally think it's important to do, is they'll also test the other halides, which interfere with the receptors for iodine, so bromine and fluoride. So they also do the same thing where when you do your 24-hour load, they'll test it before, that so you do the spot, and then you test it after. And if, say, you're excreting, like, within the normal range of bromine, because we don't want to have a lot of that, right, just a little bit of bromine, if then after the load you're excreting a huge amount, it means that when you took that extra load of iodine, the body was going in and displacing the bromine off the iodine receptors to stick the iodine in and then excreting the bromine, which means that you have an excess bromine load, and bromine is really toxic to the thyroid and other things. Same thing with fluoride. I don't see it much with fluoride. I see it a lot, which is surprising considering fluoridated water, but I see it a lot with bromine. And so what we do is then we dose people, and I have, you know, I look at it to figure out how much to dose them. You know, Dr. Brownstein and Dr. Abrams, they're a little more, less conservative than I am in the dosing. They'll just say, give everybody 50 or more. I don't do that. I kind of look at, well, what, how much did their body hold on to? How much do they really need? So if somebody held on to 45% of that 50, or say they did 50% of that 50, that means they held on to 25. Let's give them a dose of 25. That's kind of how I work it. So I try to be a little bit more conservative just because we don't want to get people into an iodine flare. But that's the way I do it. And then we go and recheck it in 3 months. And typically, even if the person isn't very low in iodine, I've had people who are like 89% in the iodine, but very high in the bromine excretion, I'll then give them that 50 for 3 months and lots of vitamin C, but not together with the iodine. But that helps with bromine detox, because people can get into bromine detox really easily. So I basically give them the 25 milligrams or whatever I'm going to give them for 3 months, and then I go back and check, and inevitably the bromine is back down. And then that says that they've eliminated the toxic bromine levels, which is awesome, right? And then their thyroid starts working better.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. Because I have a client who has thyroid issues, but I'm thinking it's more towards autoimmunity.
Mm-hmm.
But she's in Europe right now, so it's really challenging to
test, yeah,
stay connected and do tests and stuff like that. So I heard you talking about iodine testing, and it's
now the iodine testing that she can do, because the Hakala will ship all over the world. I've had them ship to Germany, Canada, Mexico, Asia. I've had them ship all over the world. They're very good about that.
Great. That's
awesome. Yeah. Now the other kind of test, the blood test, you know, she can't really, if she can't get her doctor to do it, she's not going to get it done. So
they're pretty good in Europe doing tests, I think.
Great. Well, maybe
at least cover she went
to. Yeah, that would be great. Get them to do the antibodies. More and more doctors are starting to do the antibodies, because I'm surprised usually nobody's done them. I've had people come in and on one of these group calls, they'll say, oh, I just got my labs back, and we'll say, oh, my God, you have like this outrageous autoimmune, like 1,500 antibodies. And they've had this issue, the same issues for 15 years, and been seeing doctors over their thyroid problem, but nobody ever tested their antibodies. So it's getting better because there's more of an awareness now, but it's still, you know, especially in Canada, they're really, really sticklers for not testing antibodies and not testing vitamin D except mm-hmm. once every 2 years, and, you know, ridiculous rules that they make.
Yeah, I think our antibodies were really high, but it was really hard to read because it was in different, let me see here. I have it. I just pulled it up. I wasn't even going to ask you about this today. I'm sorry.
Well, you know, the numbers, the international numbers will look higher. So I remember having somebody, and I did kind of an interpretation. I don't remember if it was like, it looked like it was 1,500, but it really was 500 in ours. So some, you know, there is a difference. But if it's over zero, I mean, any bullets over zero shooting at my thyroid, I want to deal with, right? So Joan had only a 9. But still, it says that, you know, it's not the outrageous, full-blown autoimmune, but there is some autoimmune activity, so we want to do things to dissipate that.
Awesome. Oh, yeah, I filled your thing out. It was like the units were different. I haven't picked this up in probably a month, but I've spent an entire day trying to get really clear on what was going on with hers, and the thyroid antibody was like 39.
Oh, that's terrible.
That's still pretty high, right? And
no, I mean, it's there, but it's not like I've seen them in the thousands. So that's, you know, that I can see that something like that coming down rather quickly if you do the right thing.
And the TPO is 118.
Yeah, that's high. But they're both, you know, but they're not ridiculously high.
Okay, good to know.
Yeah.
And she wants to work on digestion, too, so I think that's our next route is going the digestive route.
Always work digestion when you've got an autoimmune anything, especially thyroid. And got her, get her off of gluten if she's not already there.
She's still on gluten.
Yeah. Anybody's had a thyroid issue, they've got to get off gluten. It's not going to heal.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. My next question,
Sure.
When you put someone on a supplement plan, how long do you wait before you retest? Is it like 3 months, 4 months?
You know, it depends on what it's for and what the irregularities were. So, like for vitamin D, if they're really low on vitamin D, I'll usually test again in 6 weeks because I want to make sure we're on the right track. Because I found that some people, you can supplement 20,000 IUs of vitamin D and have them go a year and a half and it only goes up by 50 points. And other people where you put them on that same 20 because they were really low, and in 6 weeks they're good. So usually what I say to people is, look, if you're willing to test in 6 weeks, let's do 20,000. If they're very low, like say they're in the, you know, single digits or maybe low double digits, I'll say let's do 20,000 and let's retest it 6 weeks. And if you're still low, we'll continue the 20. And if you're not, and if they say, well, I don't want to test that soon, I'll say, okay, go 3 months. But at that 6 weeks, I want you to drop to 10 just in case. So it may slow them down by not testing as frequently. So that's the vitamin D. Thyroid antibodies, I probably wouldn't retest for 6 months to a year. They have to be on a really strict, and I wouldn't see it. Although I just retested somebody. No, actually, that was almost a year. We just retested somebody who started with me back about a year ago. She had labs in July, just had them redone, and her antibodies went from, like, antithyroglobulin went from 400 to 9, and the thyroid peroxidase went from, I think, 85 to 20. So huge difference. And she's off her medication now, and her TSH is perfect, and her free T3 is perfect, and her T4 is perfect. So, and that's in a year. So thyroid regular numbers, like the, I would say 4 months-ish to redo a thyroid panel, unless there's something specific I'm looking for, like if we're doing some kind of special protocol and we want to make sure it's working. But usually about 4 months. For adrenals, usually 3 to 4 months. Anything related to blood cells, like a CBC, you know, if they're anemic, I would wait 3 to 4 months, because that's how long it takes. Hemoglobin A1C, 3 to 4 months. But cholesterol, if you're putting them on a really cool program and they have really high cholesterol, and you could see differences in a month if they're strict.
Wow.
Yep. I've seen people go down 100 points in their totals and LDLs and up their HDLs in 1 month. Yeah, it's really cool.
That's great.
Uh-huh.
How about H. pylori? What's the best way to test that? I think it was...
There's a number of ways.
Dr. Shetta.
The who?
I was listening to Steph Jackson's call.
Oh, Steph,
with you.
Yeah.
And I didn't get through the whole thing. I wanted to get through the whole thing before this call because I have a feeling that there's information on H. pylori in there. I just couldn't get that far. But she was talking about doctor's data a lot, and I don't know if I have access to them.
Well, you do through us because you're in NEPT. So you have access to most of these labs through NEPT. We've made a special arrangement where you do it under our license. Doctor's data, let me see. Yeah, the best lab for the H. pylori stool is BioHealth. Although somebody said recently they found one they thought was better, but that's the one we've found the most reliable. I haven't found Genova to be that reliable because I've tested somebody and swear they had H. pylori. It didn't come up. We went back and tested on the BioHealth and it came up. So you can also do antibodies. This person just came to the States and went to their doctor and did she did an H. pylori. I think the doctor misunderstood her when she asked what she wanted because she just got back from being overseas. And we had originally done a pyloria, which is basically a genetic condition where you need a lot of B6 and zinc or else you build up this toxin called cryptopyrroles. Well, I tested her for that. And she was positive for that. And when she came back here, I think when she asked the doctor to do the test, she said pyloria, and the doctor thought she meant H. pylori. But it was one of those divine intervention mistakes because, shockingly to all of us, her H. pylori antibodies came up super high. And I didn't suspect it because she'd had so many amazing recoveries, but she still has this specific fatigue and depression and anxiety. And I'm like, where is this coming from? We're working on her oat tests. We're working on her neurotransmitters. And they're like, oh, my God, it could be the H. pylori. So it was like, oh, I'm so glad that she got that wrong because that's a thing. So, and that was just done on a routine blood test. Because blood tests aren't always going to be accurate because they're testing antibodies. Sometimes they are and sometimes they're not. The stool test tends to be more accurate. They also do saliva. They also do breath testing. None of them is 100%. None of them is 100%.
I read up on that. I actually sent my client to his own doctor to get tested for H. pylori, and his doctor wouldn't do it. He said, oh, no, the FDA doesn't do that anymore or something. And I was like, whatever, we'll do it.
Yeah, only if you have an ulcer, right? But that's the end result, right? That's like celiac. Yeah. If they don't have – they think they don't have gluten problems because they're not – puking and pooping every time they eat gluten, right? They don't have the transglutaminase that's destroying their gut. So they go, oh, yeah, you don't have a problem. Well, it affects other places first. And a lot of times it affects the neurology first. So I started really reading up on it. In our newsletter, the NEPT newsletter on Sunday, you'll see an article I wrote for that. And I gave you a bunch of links on H. pylori. So look for that because there's like 4 different links of stuff you want to look at.
This past Sunday?
No, this coming Sunday. I already wrote it.
Oh, great.
So it's going to go out on Sunday. Yeah. Yeah.
And then what are good suggestions to combat H. pylori if it does come back positive?
Well, there's some basic ones, and then Steph has a whole bunch of extras that she teaches. But I start with, because people usually don't, her stuff is really complicated, and it's for people who are really dedicated and have had this problem a long time because they're like, oh, they're mixing up these elixirs. She helps them customize it. It's really an awesome setup. But I start with, what's the name of that stuff? Metula tea as a possibility, and then the mastic gum. Any kind of gums are really good, but mastic gum tends to be good. And then some kind of antimicrobials, and I usually rotate those, like berberine and Oregon grapefruit and things like that. Oregano, trying to think off the top of my head. Some of those antimicrobials. So I'll okay. rotate those, but I always do some mastic gum. And there is a product that I've really liked from Designs for Health. And I think it's called HP Cleanse or something. But look up Designs for Health for their H. pylori product. Because a lot of times people don't want to take three or four things. Because I like to customize mm-hmm. things. I really like giving people individual things and then customizing the amounts. But that's not always popular except for the most dedicated people and the people that aren't so busy.
Right.
So if you can find a formula that works, and I have found that formula works really well.
That's great. Okay. Awesome. And then thank you so much. I just have one more question, and this one is about my own health. I put my recent lab work through the blood chemistry software, and it said that I have a health concern for muscle atrophy breakdown, and that my creatine is low.
Mm-hmm. Was your BUN low as well, or just the creatine?
Was my what?
BUN, blood urea nitrogen.
Let me look. I have it right in front of me. No, BUN was normal.
What's normal? On the blood chem software, normal? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It was 11.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, because, 11?
Mm-hmm.
I don't like 11. I usually like to have it over 13. Because I'm thinking in terms of protein, not getting enough protein or not absorbing your protein. How about your protein, your albumin, and your globulin?
Let me look here. Protein total is 7.10.
Okay.
Albumin is 4.4, and the last one was the globulin?
Yeah.
I only see the ratio.
Oh.
The albumin and globulin ratio is 1.6. Where the heck is...
Okay, and those are all falling within their normal ranges?
Yeah.
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 Well, you know, it could be that you are exercising a lot and you're not taking in enough amino acids to replenish it.
Okay. Because I remember I was telling you when we were on the retreat, like I have a hard time keeping weight on and muscle.
That's
like
right.
I can almost feel it, like
feel it going away.
Yeah.
That's right.
Especially around my upper body.
The protein, right. So mm-hmm. it's keeping up your protein levels and maybe even looking at supplemental proteins when you're not feeling like eating meat all the time.
Yeah, and I do every morning within the first hour. Which I learned from you as well. Mm-hmm. I take a shake and drink it in the first hour of all kinds of good stuff. And there's protein in there too.
Mm-hmm. So and look at your HCL. Look at your ability to make HCL. Look and see if that's a possibility. You can do the HCL challenge. That's a possibility. Enzymes, that kind of stuff, but you want to boost that, taking bitters before your meals to help it and see if that helps. But for a while, just increasing the protein because you work out a lot, right? You're not a typical couch potato, so you work out a lot and you're going to need more protein and you are very lean and muscular, so you're going to need more protein than somebody who's a couch potato.
Yeah, right now I'm in Aspen with my clients for, looks like the better of the summer, and all we do is work out and eat. I mean, I'm like constantly asking for food, and I feel like, oh my God, I still can't like put on any weight. Like I just want to, you know, stabilize.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. Yeah, so
I was just wondering if there was
look at. But I would start with that. I would start with looking at your HCL and making sure that's there. And there's a couple of amino acid supplements that are good. Purium makes one called MAP. I think there's other companies that make it as well. But it's amino acids that you can take, like a big handful of those before you exercise and work out, and it prevents wasting. I find that when I take it before I work out, when I remember to take it before I work out, I can go faster and longer and stronger.
It's called MAP, M-A-P?
M-A-P, yes. Because what happens is if you go out and you don't have, say you're burning a lot, you are going to need the fuel. And if you exceed, like if you're going into cortisol levels, like where you're raising your cortisol because you're exercising super hard, then you're going to burn, mm-hmm. you're going to burn lean. And it sounds to me like when you're working out, you're burning lean rather than fat.
Yeah.
Because you don't have much fat. Right. So if you give your body some lean to burn, like you give them this amino acids right 20 minutes before you go out and work out, then it takes those and it uses those. It'll take the branch chains in those and convert it to sugar for you while you're exercising. So it can give you a better workout. So I'd look into that. And when I do it, I do muscle testing on myself, but I generally, when I'm working out, I usually take between 5 and 10 of those before I go out.
Okay. 5 and 10 of the supplements.
Because
I drink
yeah.
a protein powder first thing in the morning.
Yeah.
Before
yeah.
I work out. And then
try this.
I'll have like...
Just try and see if it makes okay. a difference. Because it's the free
great,
form.
It will.
So you doesn't have to work at it. I mean, it's just an experimentation right now without doing more
yeah.
exhaustive testing. Okay?
Awesome. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That's all my questions. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Super. Glad you came on. Bye.
Yeah, me too. Thanks.
All right. So, Grace, you're back. I decided not to continue your thing while you were gone so that you could see
uh-huh.
it. So I'm going to pull yours up again. I was going to just go over your methylation one, which is, there's a change, that's temps. There you go. Okay, so let's look at that. And I'll share my screen. Okay. Whoops, share screen, where did it go? Okay, can you see my screen now? Everybody see
yes.
it?
Yes.
Methylation? Okay, so here's my concern here, Grace. You know you had those two SNPs that were related to estrogen and caffeine on your detox one?
Yes.
These top two, this COM-T, that are homozygous for you are related to the same thing. So even more so, those are super important to handle, like making sure that you're always careful about getting tons of those cruciferous vegetables. But also you have to be careful about too much methylation. So you've got this MTHFR, C77T, and the typical thing is, oh, just take a whole bunch of folate, methylfolate. And if you take too much methylfolate, that methylfolate can get trapped. And if you ever notice that when if you take too many B vitamins, you feel anxious, agitated, it's because of something's going on in these pathways. So this COM-T works on dopamine, serotonin, and estrogen and caffeine, and it interferes with the ability to break them down. Not so much the caffeine, but the others. And it interferes with the ability to break them down and eliminate them properly. So you get builds up of these metabolites of serotonin and dopamine. And so if you eat too many methyl groups, if you take too much methyl B12 or methylfolate or SAMe or MSM or any of those supplements, you could cause yourself to be anxious. And it may have happened to you once or twice and you didn't even notice it, but it's something to be aware of.
Okay, so the MAO one is also related to the breakdown of neurotransmitters.
Yes, and the MAO is big time. And when you have that combination of MAO with the COM-Ts, it often leads to like obsessive compulsive type behaviors. Like you're just like, you know, have to be perfect, have to do this. And that may or may not apply to you. I don't know you well enough to know that, but I've seen that happen with a lot of people. Now the combination of that with the VDRs, which is your vitamin D receptors, those all come together to have that. You have to be careful about excess neurotransmitter metabolites.
Okay.
And
so
agitation and all that.
Okay, so my vitamin D is over 100, and I'm doing great with that. But I have noticed, like you said, when I take B vitamins, which I need for, you know, detox and, you know, things that I'm supposed to have, inert and so forth. I cannot, I wondered which B vitamin is it, because it keeps me from sleeping. Like I can't sleep.
Yeah, that's it. So it's the methylated Bs in there, the methylated B12 and folate, those two.
Okay.
So, and you want to look at the doses. So Seeking Health is a company that makes a lot of stuff to support these methylations. They make a supplement called B minus. And it's B minus. It's the Bs minus the folate and the B12. Now it doesn't mean you don't need them, because you have SNPs that say you do need them. But then you can get separately. They have liposomal B12 and liposomal folate, so you can titrate to your appropriate amount. So you take the B complex that doesn't have those in it, and then you just play with the dose of the Bs in the liposomal form. And for the B12. If you can't tolerate any of it methylated, then there's another form called hydroxy, which can be very helpful.
Okay, so when I've had my B tested, now this is a blood test, but when I've had it tested, I'm like 1,500. I mean, I'm way out the
Because you're not methylating it. You're not getting it into your cells.
Okay, so that's the reason, right?
That's the reason, yeah. So you do need those methylated Bs, but it's agitating you. It's not a good thing. So you want to back off on that, get the Seeking Health B minus capsules, B complex minus or something, whatever it's called. Lynn just posted a link to it.
Yeah.
And then get the liposomal B12, methylated B12, liposomal methylated folate. And then you can also get, and this is a lot of stuff, but it's going to last you forever. You know, it's going to last you a long time, because you're just going to do tiny doses. Then you can also get some hydroxy B12, and that'll give you a benefits in that, but your body can slowly convert that one.
Okay, so does that mean that because I cannot, I can't take it in because of the SNPs, does that mean I'm deficient?
Your cells might be deficient, yeah. Your methylation pathways, your DNA repair pathways, and everything that uses it can be deficient, yeah.
Okay.
That's why I want you to do this in another way.
Okay.
Right, and B12 is not a good one to take in an oral supplement anyway, because most people have impaired intrinsic factors by the time they get to be over the age of 40 or 50 because of all the abuse. Even younger people sometimes do, and you need that for B12. So B12 is not that well absorbed unless you do a sublingual or a liposomal anyway. So the B complex is good for everything else. The folate and the B12 you do separately.
Okay. Now, the fact that all of these three top red ones are important for breaking down neurotransmitters, is there anything in that that I need to know?
Yeah, the B6 is super important. So that's in your B complex. B6 is super important.
I mean, if I can't break them down, that means they're still around, right? So that would
It means they're still around, which makes you a little bit more anxious and a little bit more, you know, restless, irritable, that kind of stuff. So,
I'm not crazy after all.
It's my genes!
Oh, dear.
Yeah, so, and I would say, you know, calming things would be good, right, to counteract that. So looking at some herbs, looking at lavender, rubbing them on your feet at night, lemon balm can be really helpful. Mm-hmm. A lemon balm plant, you need to squeeze the leaves. Just all these different things that are going to be nervines, you know, that are calming your nerves. So, because these are making your nerves a little jittery, and you want to do things to counteract it. That's
no kidding. Well, passion flower seems to work for me.
Yeah.
And I've been doing the magnesium, mixing magnesium oil with lavender and some lemon balm and rubbing them on my feet before I go to bed.
Great.
And so.
Just keep doing all those things, right? It's genetic, so it's not going to go away. It's not like, I'm just going to get sufficient and it's genetic. It's going to go away. It's not going to go away. And so you just have to support it the best you can.
Okay.
Okay.
And so what about the CBS one, the red one that's down
there? Yeah, the CBS is the sulfation pathways. So some of those are what they call upregulated, meaning that the CBS is moving it's basically, it's the pathway that takes homocysteine. Let's just think of homocysteine sitting in the middle of a page. And up above, homocysteine is supposed to get converted around to methionine and SAMe. And you need adequate B12 and folate in the methylated forms to do that. Now, going down from that, you can get rid of the homocysteine in another way by sending it down into the sulfation pathway, which makes glutathione. CBS is one of the enzymes that pulls it down. Now, if you have dysregulations in both, you can get, if the CBS is underacting, you're going to get a buildup of homocysteine. So you can actually test your homocysteine and see where that's at. But sometimes the CBS is an under, an over, so it's depleting it. So you might not have enough B12 and folate, but your homocysteine is going to be fine anyway. So it's hard to say. And then the other problem is with that is you can get buildups of things like sulfites. So I know you're careful about what you eat. You're not going to eat dried fruits that have been put sulfur on it. Really being careful about any sulfur things. And just seeing how you feel when you do sulfur, like MSM. Well, I wouldn't do MSM at all, so I wouldn't do that. But when you eat the sulfur-containing foods like garlic and cruciferous and those sorts of things, if you feel better or you feel worse. Because, you know, without going in and testing, which you can, by the way, there's expensive tests that you can test all these in real time. Without going in and testing, a lot of it is just kind of guesswork. You play around with it and you see, and you find your tolerance level. Like anything else, just like sugar, right? With blood sugar, going all the way back to IRSPC, which a lot of people are in, it's blood sugar. And for everybody, it's a little different what they can eat to maintain that perfect blood sugar level. And it's also, each person's a little different as to when, what blood sugar level they feel best at. You know, I've been discovering I feel best when my blood sugar is like 68.
Mm-hmm.
When I feel best, right? Somebody else would go, oh, I feel like I'm getting hit by a truck if I'm 68. But I feel really clear. And when it starts to go up, I start to get hungry, which is weird, right? So we all have to just dig in and understand where your body's at and go from there.
Okay, well, that's great. Thank you so very much. So I don't, so the fact that I have dopamine, norepinephrine, all that stuff, serotonin running around and not being broken down is not necessarily a problem. But
it's not necessarily a problem. It's going to make you feel agitated. So here's the deal. I have some of those too. Okay. I don't have reds on my COMTs, but I do have yellows. I do have double MTHFR. I do have a red MAO, and I have a whole bunch of other things related to GABA. I know this about myself. I know I can get that way. So I'm just doing a lot more heart math than I would if I didn't have all that, right? I'm counteracting it because I know that about myself, right? And it's just like, oh, yeah, there's my genes again. Okay. You know, so we have to just pick up our little tools that we can use to counteract our silly genes because we can't control them. We can epigenetically control them. And then we do that by reducing stress, reducing cortisol. Like if it's norepinephrine, right, it can't get rid of norepinephrine real well, and that's adrenaline, and it builds up and you get that agitated. Well, just turn off the norepinephrine, right? Just don't find yourself calming yourself down and going from sympathetic to parasympathetic deliberately a lot more. Then you're not taxing those pathways, right? It's just like the detox pathways, right? You're not taxing a detox pathway that says you can't break down heterocyclic amines if you're not, like, sitting in exhaust fumes and eating charbroiled meat. So – like for me, I have a lot of those SNPs, but I've been pretty pristine about my diet lifestyle for about 35 years. So at least 30. And so I haven't been taxing those pathways. So that's the thing, epigenetic modification.
Okay.
That's why it's nice to know what these things are, because you know where you have to be more careful. Make sense?
Well, thank you so much. Yes,
yeah,
I appreciate it with all my heart.
Oh, sure. You're welcome.
Okay.
And these things, you know, for those of you going, ooh, I want to do these with my clients, it takes a while to learn these things, right? It takes a while. We have a whole module in our NEPT program on this, and it gets expanded all the time. We have a whole module in our ERC program because it's complicated. It's complicated science, and I'm always learning more. I don't know everything there is to know. I just keep learning more, and it's wonderful to keep learning more. So there were a couple of other questions typed in, which I'm going to get to. It was Grace's. Judy, is there any relationship between ADHD and insulin resistance? If someone's insulin resistance is getting harder to control, could that make their ADD become worse? Absolutely. Person I'm thinking about isn't eating junk food with chemicals and dyes and refined sugars, but eating lots of protein and not enough vegetables. He'll eat one small salad a day, mainly his diet is protein, organic meat, and organic pastured eggs and coffee. Well, yeah, ADD. So, it's a matter of focus in the brain, right? And there is this whole spectrum. ADD, I think, is on the spectrum with Asperger's. I was going to say Alzheimer's. No, Asperger's and autism, right? And so it's that the brain can't calm itself down. And when the brain isn't getting enough fuel or the cells are resistant in there, then the ADD will get worse for sure. So absolutely. So, you know, working on this person, it doesn't sound like their diet's bad. They don't have any sugars, it doesn't look like, but they just don't have enough vegetables. It's just mainly too much protein. So I would be looking, and protein can get converted to glucose, by the way. So I mean, just do your stuff with them and teach them the heart math. It's really amazing for ADD. Heart Math Institute, if you go to their site, actually has some good stuff, depending on the age of this person, but where the learning tools, where they help with how to help kids learn by using these heart math techniques. So I think that could be very helpful. Okay. Okay, so Dorte in Copenhagen. I have a few follow-up questions to let you know that this healing, the client she's been working with, his healing is overwhelmingly well. Doing your reset diet, found that gluten was one of the culprits. His postprandial insulin level is low, very much like normal, non-diabetic. It rises and goes down and stabilizes within an hour. His blood sugar in the evening and nighttime is down and is normal. Yay. However, the morning fasting is still high, although it's fallen 2 points. It's now between 7 and 9, previously 12. So that's a lot better. This is the European 7 to 9 is still quite high. I would say like 5-ish is in the 90 range. So 7 to 9 is still quite high, but if it was previously 12, which would be in the 200s. So leaving out the gluten in the bread has resulted in him losing too much weight. He's not overweight and he's hungry all the time. I suspect that his body's in the process of learning how to burn fat instead of sugar, being one of the reasons why he's hungry all the time. Possibly, and he may not be getting enough calories, so it's because if he's getting a lot of calories from his breads, they're highly caloric, you need to make up the calories. So I'd be looking at getting him to have more healthy fats as well. So when people can't maintain their weight, they start to lose weight on an insulin resistance diet, you need to up their fat and protein. And you want to do that in a healthy way. You don't want to have them be just eating, you know, 20 ounces of meat every day, because that's not a healthy way to do it. You know, 6 ounces of meat a day is better, but where do they get that? So some of the folks that are really thin, you want to look at also maybe some things like quinoa and legumes as well, but certainly coconut, avocado, like get them to eat a couple of avocados a day. That's what my son always did. He just had this massive appetite, so he would just make this big bowl of guacamole and eat it with, you know, carrots and celery and sometimes some non-gluten chips. Yeah, and when people are low in their weight, you know, our whole thing about meal spacing, ideally for everything, it's better for leptin levels, for gut motility, for insulin. But in people who are very thin, they are going to go into fat burning in between meals, which you don't want them to. So if you can space their meals a little closer, you know, maybe closer to 3.5 to 4 hours, rather than the 4 to 6 or 3 hours, but make sure that what they're eating in between is not something that's going to cause a lot of insulin. So I like to get them on some, you know, guacamole and celery sticks as a snack in between, or a shake that's, you know, a bunch of blended greens with an avocado in there. That's not going to raise the blood sugar. I test mine all the time just to see. And when I do my my shakes that are just all greens with avocado, my sugar goes up like 5 to 10 points at the most. So that's not going to impact, you know, the whole healing process. But, yeah, you need to get them to eat more frequently. The 5-hour is not going to work for somebody who's just losing all that weight. They have a high metabolic rate. So 3 hours might be better, especially if he's eating low glycemic. He has been reintroducing a bit of the homemade rye bread without the postprandial yeah, get him off the rye bread. That's too, he's diabetic. He's got inflammation. He's not going to heal his receptors if he's eating gluten. So hot rye bread, if it's, you can make in our recipe guide, the B4 recipe guide, there's a bunch of different recipes for different breads and crackers that are quite hefty. Quite hefty because they have a fair amount of fat. They have nuts or seeds and avocado and things like that. Plus, they have all the veggies. And so the fiber fills, but the fat really sustains. So that's where I would look at there. And if somebody's blood sugar goes up during the night, I'm looking at what's stressing them during the night, possibility of parasites, and possibility of having their sugar go down too low in the middle of the night, which only happens when they're eating at bedtime and they eat too much in the way of a carb meal. If he has trauma, if he has cortisol levels going up in the middle of the night, that happens too, that people were, you know, there was some sort of a trauma that happened in the middle of the night for them. So I would look at that. No nightmares, no hidden traumas. History of epilepsy does yoga. Yeah, I would test his adrenals for sure. Yeah, when anybody's having those high levels in the morning and they're not going down, I'm looking for some kind of stress during the night that's causing a cortisol rise. It's possible that he has LADA. You would want to get antibodies tested, right? So if it doesn't come down, it looks like it's coming down a fair amount, but LADA is certainly something to rule out. If he has postprandial insulin, so say he does a before meal, a fasting insulin, and it's 3, and then you do a postprandial insulin, and it's 3, and they've eaten some carbs in that meal, that's probably not a good sign. That's probably a sign of pancreatic insufficiency. So when you're testing that, you want to make sure that there is some carb, whether it's a bowl of blueberries or something, you know, really mild, but just something that's going to cause some carb in there to see if it raises his insulin levels. If it stays at the same, then I'm suspicious, and then I would go and test some of the, some of the antibodies, like the anti-islet cell antibodies, the anti-insulin antibodies. Yeah. So helpful if I know you're on a different time zone, but it would be Copenhagen is probably okay to be on the call right now. If you ever can get on the call and we could chat, I can go back and forth with you and maybe give you some additional ideas beyond that. So let me see. I'm going to refresh that. And then I'm going to go back to here. And who has their hand up? Grace's hand I got. I'm going to go to the chat. Oh, there's Jamie. Oh, Jamie posted another liposomal B complex, but I'm concerned about the complex for her because I want her to be able to titrate her individual Bs. Okay, so let me see if there's anything in the other chat. Raise your hand if you need it. I'll come back and look at that in a minute. Lynn's been posting a lot of links, everything we've been talking about. Carol, on the Hakala, and everybody, get the full thing. Tell them you want the whole thing. You want the spot test on the iodine and the halides, and then you want the 24-hour load on the halides and then you'll get the best thing. After that, you may not have to do the whole thing again, but that's the best way to start. Absolutely. I've seen people not do that, and then we don't get the information. Okay, let's see. Oh, we still have yesterday's up because I didn't shut this down. Okay, so if there's anything else that I didn't answer, please type it into the chat and I'll get to it. If you have a question and you're on the line, do a star 2. And Grace put her hand up again. So there we go. Huh? I didn't know if you had put it up again or I didn't put you down.
No, I put it up again. I have two more questions. Thank you for answering. Sure. What would you recommend for non-motility because of autoimmune gut condition to move things through while things are healing?
Good question. So Is it constipation? Is that what you mean, or is this in
yes.
general? Because so there's a couple of things. Is it a thyroid autoimmune condition?
I don't really know that. It's an autoimmune something, and my mother has a repetitive stress syndrome where she gets lumps in her, you know, and so she's been seeing a DOM, and the woman has just helped her tremendously. She's surely not where she was, but she has fatigue. She has had chronic fatigue for years, and she's kind of pulling out of that, but I mean, this is a woman who had to do an enema every night or even two or three times a day.
Wow.
And so.
Okay. Yeah, so there's a couple of things. So the motility actually starts up further, right? So you want to make sure there's some vagus nerve stimulation exercises.
Okay.
There's things like singing, and there's things like, gargling. Gag reflex, there's a whole bunch of stuff that she can do to stimulate that vagus nerve, okay? That stimulates what's called the migrating motor complex, which is in the gut, and it moves things through.
Mm-hmm.
The migrating motor complex, in order for it to be active, you need to be leaving at least 3.5 to 4 hours between meals. So people are eating too frequently, and it causes that migrating motor complex to paralyze. So that's another thing. There's a couple of herbs that she might try for the upper part, and then I could talk about some herbs for the lower part. The lower part's usually just laxatives to get them to move more quickly, and I'd rather see what the root cause is. The other root cause can be the liver. So when the liver is sluggish and stagnant, so there are things that help, you know, if it's a Chinese medicine looks at this a lot, is it a moist constipation or a dry constipation, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is it, if it's really dry and brittle constipation, it could be liver and, you know, the liver can moisten. And Dong Quai is a really good herb for that. Usually, you know, people also have female hormone stuff, but not necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing with the migrating motor complex, Pure Encapsulations has a formula called Motil Pro, MOTILPRO.
Okay.
And it has some ginger and a couple of other herbs, has 5-HTP and B6, because it helps with getting the serotonin. When serotonin is low, then your motility, serotonin and dopamine both affect the motility of the GI tract. So that product might be good. And the Ayurvedic herb called Trifala can be a good one to try.
Okay.
And then from the other end, I mean, obviously enemas to keep things moving. The other kinds of things are more stimulants for the lower, for the gut. It's not really, they're more symptomatic stuff, like if you're doing Senna or Cascara or any of those things. Those, I think, are more, you know, they're just causing the gut to go into spasm to release things. But if the motility problem's higher up, it's not going to really help the problem root cause. But you also want to look at ileocecal valve. Is her ileocecal valve stuck in a shut position? It's not opening and closing the way it should. And you can look up ileocecal valve massage. And you can find things like videos of it on YouTube. I'm sure you'll find little things. We have it in our CMDS, our Clinical Mastery of the Digestive System. We have whole discussions on all of this.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. And my last question is, what lab do you use to test for parasites?
Good question. So sometimes BioHealth, sometimes Doctor's Data. I like Doctor's Data because they give you a really nice report that if they find anything, they test it to see what it's sensitive to and what it works with. And so I really don't use the BioHealth as much anymore. I use that for H. pylori, but not for that. I like Doctor's Data right now the best.
Okay. Thank you so much for your time, Rita Marie.
You're so welcome, Grace. Bye.
Bye.
All right. Anybody else? Let's see. Black sesame seeds can be helpful if it's an immediate problem. You mean like an acute constipation type thing? I mean, there's a lot of things that can be used for acute constipation, right? But this is a longstanding problem, so you want to get at is, you know, what's going on. Liver, thyroid. You know, migrating motor complex, vagus nerve, hyper sympathetic, those kind of things. Sometimes they say it's an early sign of Parkinson's constipation, so that there's some loss of motility because of some loss of motility in the brain. And, you know, that's a more severe. I heard Dr. Karazian talked a bunch about that. Okay, anybody else? Okay, we're good. I got 5 minutes before I have to be on for the next call. Some of you might have gotten on early for the next call. You guys are welcome to hang out for the next call. The next call is our Vibrant Living members. One of these days, we're going to not have them back to back because it's really an intense day at once a month. And plus, it's probably better to spread them out. So thank you all for being here. I'll open up the line so you can all say goodbye to each other. And we'll talk to you again real soon. Bye, everyone.
Thanks, Rich Marie.
Bye.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Sure, bye.